Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
This is Sports Radio 670 The Score and 670thescore.com. Chicago Sports Station.
5 at 5 brought to you by Sport Clips. Cut the wait. Download the new Sport Clips Haircuts app and check in.
It's 5 at 5 with Mully and Hall, where we debate the top 5 sports stories of the day and then open it up to you, the Chicago sports fan. Call us at 312-644-6767, or you can tweet your thoughts at Mully Hall. 5 at 5 with Mully and Hall starts now.
What was your main takeaway from the All-Star game, and which local player had the biggest impact?
I find it nostalgic, the All-Star game. My biggest takeaway was that there were so many young guys and so many kind of unknown players and so many people going through this for the first time. And I kept thinking to myself about the two White Sox players, you know, James McCann, the incredible story of him getting to this point and going to an All-Star game. And, of course, Lucas Giolito, the first guy ever to have the worst ERA in the league 1 year and be an All-Star the next. So I think both those guys, you can make a case for Giolito, who walked the first guy he faced but ended up getting out of the inning without an issue, retiring the next three. And it was funny because I was very nervous about it, and I said to my kid, I'm like, look at the guys he's got to face. It's like he's facing an All-Star team. And we laughed. I think McCann might be the answer to the question, though. I think he might be the guy with the biggest impact because he made a really big catch, and obviously he had a single in the game as well. So I would say that of the two of them, and unfortunately, all three of the Cubs struck out, right? And Abreu didn't get anything done either. So I'm going to go with James McCann as the local guy with the biggest impact.
Yeah, I think Giolito, because what he's been able to do this year as opposed to what he had to mentally and physically recover from last year,
right,
and what he's been able to accomplish and the whole thrill of the All-Star game. And then James McCann caught him, correct? I think he was the catcher when Giolito was in the game. And then to have what he was able to accomplish, he had a hit in the seventh inning. He caught a big foul ball that stopped a rally by the National League. So I think he's the type of guy that, because he's got a lot of responsibility and a lot of pressure on him being for the Sox, because the Sox are looking to try to accomplish something. The thing that was scary is when Chris Bryant joked about himself as being, maybe I'm just a utility man. And you talked about him in the pre-show introduction about putting me at one position and leaving at one position. Is he starting to believe that? Is he starting to believe that maybe I am just a utility guy? And listen, he's an awesome player. He's one of the greatest Cubs for generations. But like you, rather than having him making that joking comment about himself, about maybe I'm a utility man, let him play one position and let somebody else on the roster be a utility man and let Chris Bryant stay at one position.
Let him be a star.
What Giolito was able to overcome from last year, go to the All-Star game, and then whatever short opportunity he have, go in there and fulfill your obligations and walk out of the game as an All-Star, as you walked in as an All-Star.
I think the conversation around Bryant and his utility and where he plays on the diamond is a really interesting one. I'd like to hear you guys get into that a little bit more. I feel like his versatility makes him an even better player than he already is, you know, being able to play either corner of the infield, either corner of the outfield. I think it just increases his value. But again, you know, you guys can get into that a little bit later. As far as last night, Bryant did not have much of an impact in this game, just had the one at bat. I'm going to go with Giolito, even though McCann did what we've seen him do all year long, go the opposite field and just kind of go about his business, make a pretty good catch and just, you know, move the runners along and just the same thing we've seen from him all year. So it was good to see that. But I think Giolito coming in facing those dangerous hitters that he did have to face. I mean, Cody Bellinger is
I know.
MVP of either league yeah. right now, you know. And he
left. Arenado, and then, yeah. then when Josh Bell gets up, I Josh threw Bell. My hands up. Are you kidding me?
Especially with what he did to the Cubs yes. most recently. Yeah, but yeah, he locked up Bellinger after the walk, got Arenado, got Bell. So that was probably what I will remember the most from last night's game, because all due respect to James McCann, who's having a great season, and I hope it continues. I think Giolito has many more All-Star games in his future than James McCann, and I think this would be the good a good first one for his resume going forward, because hopefully there's going to be a lot more.
My biggest takeaway was I thought this was going to be the year finally the National League broke the streak, and it didn't happen. The AL won for the seventh consecutive time, so that's my biggest takeaway. I thought it was finally the streak was finally going to end, and it did not. Local player that made the biggest impact to me was Lucas Giolito, because when he came in at first, when he walked Freddie Freeman there right. in the fourth inning, he looked a little wild, and I, you know, you can't blame him for being nervous. I thought, wow, he's nervous here. Maybe he could give up the couple runs, get into a jam, and he did not. He struck out Bellinger, and he recovered and got out of the inning scoreless. So to me, Lucas Giolito for getting over that walk, looking a little nervous, and then maintaining composure after that.
My biggest takeaway is that Home Run Derby needs to be a two-night event. I mean, that game wow. was absolute drag until like the fifth inning. I also thought Lucas Giolito kind of sort of got disrespected by not at least going third, if not second. Kevin and I were talking about this. I guess it doesn't matter if you don't start when you throw in the huge picture. But I was like, come on already. Like, as a Chicago sports fan, I am not a White Sox fan, but I am a Chicago sports fan, and I have been enjoying what Lucas Giolito has been doing this year. Any sports fan with a pulse has to be intrigued by what he's doing. But you know, the walk kind of, how was that a clean inning? Kevin played the quote in his update. You know, clean. That's not a clean inning. You walked a guy. Now, no, he did a great job.
No errors, no runs scored. Got out of it 1-2-3 after the first
after the walk, but it wasn't clean.
It's relatively clean.
It was a four. No, it's not clean. That's not clean.
It's tidy.
And again, the other part of the question isn't whose game last night carries over to the future. Okay, James McCann was by far the all-star of Chicago baseball last night. Okay, that was a great catch. The hit he had put guys on first and third, right? I mean, come on, let's give this guy his credit.
Dustin, I'm surprised you didn't answer Aroldis Chapman, because he got booed when he came in because of winning the World Series with the Cubs. I thought that was a great local
moment.
They
were all getting booed. It was hilarious.
Yeah, that could have been
Chapman
my other takeaway,
the
that the Cleveland fans are still petty.
You said the game was boring, Dust. You weren't really on the edge of your seat or anything?
I was not on the edge of my seat.
I wouldn't say I was on the edge of my seat. I wouldn't say it was boring.
I was with Giolito. Walked that guy.
I was upset that I wasn't on the edge of my seat. I don't need to see it. Oh, here's another one, and maybe I missed it. How many games has Wilson Contreras played at third base this year?
That's a good question. Probably
zero?
Probably one. Probably I would remember maybe one time.
I don't remember one.
Yeah, maybe this year. Why?
I heard Joe Buck say that.
Oh, Joe Buck was dreadful, wasn't he?
I was like, what? Wilson Contreras, who can play third base?
So I liked the game. I like pitching. You know, I think good pitching normally will beat good hitting, and last night you saw that. But Joe Buck, I'm so done with him. Like,
too much mic'd up. The Freddie Freeman thing was great in the first inning, but then they had to have the overkill and the three Astros chatting amongst themselves. That's really
Lindor was good. Lindor was good.
That was great.
Yeah.
You know, as smart as you guys are, that might be the best question you've ever asked. I'm serious. I had never really contemplated this question.
The Cubs have been a great second-half team in the Joe Maddon era. How many of their final 72 games do you anticipate them winning, and will they win the division?
How many are you going to win? That's such a hard question to answer, yeah. But this is what I like. You know, I think one thing when you look at sports teams, and no matter how many games you play, whether it's a 16-game NFL season or what they have in baseball, so I like the fact that the Cubs division is so close, because I think it's going to keep them mentally motivated to have the winning approach to every single game. Because you look at some of these games at the second half of the season, some of these teams that are so far out of it, they're already in a kind of a complacent state, and it's just going to be hard for them to be motivated enough to go out there throughout some of these hot summertime games and put forth enough energy to go out there and have a good showing. I think every team in the Cubs division, they believe they have an opportunity to win the division. So whether it's the Cubs or any of the other teams here, I think it's going to be an exciting second half of the season because they're all so close and they all believe, look, if we tweak this one area, if this one player comes out and has a better second half than he did at first half, if, you know, if there's a pitcher that can contribute a couple more innings, a couple more wins, then we're going to have find ourselves in the race. So I think it's just an exciting second half of the season when you consider how short of a distance there is between the first place team and the last place team. So I think it's going to be exciting. But to guess the amount of wins, you know, if you're a fan like my nephew, you're going to win every one of them. But if you're realistic, you got to win just to stay in first place and get yourself into the playoffs.
It's fascinating, Tom, because I agree with what you're saying. I think that the division is so kind of bunched up that, again, you know, given how they've played toward the break, it's almost miraculous that they are a half game ahead of Milwaukee. And as you look at it and you contemplate all these teams, I would say that 87 wins could win this division, which would be the fewest to win the division since, like, I don't know, in 20-something, 30-something years. I mean, it's hard to believe that that you don't need that many wins. When the Cubs last year, they went 40-30 after the break, and they wound up with 95 wins, and it wasn't enough. They had to play the extra game, and then they wound up losing that one and didn't win the division, and Milwaukee won it. So 95 wasn't enough a year ago. You look at it, they have they've won 47 of 90 in the first half, so the final 72. Their record has to be at least 42-30, probably closer to like 46-26 in order to definitely secure the division. Under Joe Madden, 2015, 50-25. 2016, 50-23. 2017, 49-25. And then, of course, as we said, last year, 40-30. So they're going to need 40-plus wins without a shadow of a doubt. I'm going to say a minimum of 42, and they probably, if they can get 46, then they're laughing. So I would say 46-26 is a big ask, but that's probably what they need to secure the division. But maybe, just maybe, 42 is enough.
46 wins would be a tremendous ask for this team. They're four games over 500. They haven't been able to put together a run like that for the entire first half of the season, so it gives me no confidence in them to do the same.
Kevin, 42-30 is asking a lot of a team that's just four games. But again, they are a second-half team.
They are, and they have been traditionally. And even last year, Molly, you bring up their record after the break last year. It was still very good. People have this thought in their mind that they faded down the stretch. They choked. They blew the division. It's just that Milwaukee last season down the stretch, and Christian Yelich in particular, were on such a different planet that the Cubs playing well looked like they weren't playing well because they weren't scoring a lot of runs, and the Brewers were just unbelievable. So it's not like they were bad in the second half last year, but this is not the same team even as last year's team. You mentioned they won 95 games. I think they probably win 86, 87 this year, which would put them, what, around 39, 40 wins here in the second half of the season. And I do think that would be enough to win this division. I think it's a very flawed division. I don't think that there's one standout team particularly. And I think the Cubs are the best of a very flawed bunch, but there are still a lot of question marks that I have surrounding their situational hitting, the pitching staff and the age of the pitching staff, how those guys being veterans will progress through the second half of the season when guys tend to tail off a little bit. And also that back end of the bullpen, until you see Craig Kimbrel kind of get back into some semblance of a groove and his vintage performances of a couple of years ago, I think every ninth inning might be a little bit more of an adventure than Cub fans would like, and I'm not convinced that he's still the same guy. So there are question marks all over the place, but the Cubs aren't the only team with question marks. All of these teams in this division, like I said, very flawed and a lot of question marks, but I do see the Cubs winning the division with 40 wins in the second half, which would take them to 87, if I could get the math correct at this time in the morning.
Yeah, the NL Central is very tight, and I wrote down 40 and 32, which, yes, I agree with Kev, gets them to 87 wins, and I think that is enough to win the division. Look, the Cubs traditionally are better in the second half after the All-Star break. So if that holds true, then I think the Cubs can win the division, absolutely. If that does not hold true this season and these struggles from the first half prior to the All-Star break continue, they're going to be in trouble because of how tight it is. So I'm going to go with the traditional trend that, yeah, the Cubs play better after the All-Star game and say that they do win the division with 87 wins.
Yeah, 40 is the key number here. I think if you're under 40, I think you got no shot, none at all. I think 40 makes it really tight, and what is it right now? It's really tight, right? They're up by a half game. Mully, I think, you know, if they got to 46, I think they win the game. I think they win the game. They win the division going away if they were at 46. 50 would be an absolute miracle. I'm all for it. I'd love to get on board, and I'd love to root that 50 on. But I think 40 is the magic number. And I think coming out of the gate here, they've got the Pirates and the Reds, and those are two series that you better win. Okay, you better not leave. You better not lose any series. Basically, I don't think you can afford to lose any series at home moving forward. I think you got to take two out of three, assuming they're all three-game series. I'm not looking that deep.
You might want to win a road series, too.
Well, that would be nice. But what I'm saying is, based on how they've played the first half, you cannot afford to let any home series get away from you. Okay, you better be playing like 650-ish baseball at home, the very least. And I think, again, 40 is this magic number.
It's a great question.
Does Jose Abreu's enthusiasm to stay with the White Sox influence your opinion on wanting him to stay, and do the White Sox need him?
You know, I got to tell you, I wondered to myself if Billy Russo was actually giving the correct translation, because it's three times now that Abreu has said that no matter what, he's coming back. If they don't sign him, he's going to sign anyway. And I'm thinking, shouldn't he negotiate? Maybe that's a great way of negotiating.
His agent probably seething somewhere.
Yeah, exactly. It's insane that he said that. I love that he said that, and it makes me happy that he wants to be a part of it. He hasn't been a part of any winning on the South Side, but he's been there, and he sees what's coming, and he wants to stay. Yes, his enthusiasm has influenced my opinion, and I now want him to stay. And I was one of the guys that wanted him traded. I thought you could get something for him. I also thought, if he really wants to be on the South Side that much, why not trade him to a contender for any kind of piece and then re-sign him at the end of the year and do the oldest Chapman? I don't think you're getting Gleyber Torres for a first baseman, but wouldn't that be nice to get something? The Sox do need him. Yeah, he's a really good player. He's a very professional player. He's a professional hitter. Did you see the guy they signed yesterday, Reed? He's not going to Charlotte. He's joining them in Oakland. So he's coming right onto the major league roster from Houston. So he's a DH first baseman type. I guess he replaces Daniel Polka effectively and on the roster. So, I think they do need Jose Abreu, and I do now want him to stay, and I love that he wants to be here, and I'm a sucker for a guy that is not afraid to just say it and not worry about negotiations.
I don't know why anybody wants to escort him out the door.
Well, I just think you get value for him. He's 32. And
right,
look
at what ultimately you're trying to accomplish. Look at the influence that you need. You know, there's players in every league that are over 30 years old that they're the most positive, biggest, most serious influence in their locker room. And who's the biggest bat when they go to opponent stadiums where you need a big hit? You need someone that's intimidating up at the plate other than Eloy Jimenez or you know, Tim Anderson when he's healthy and stuff. You need that guy that has that first base presence, that's a big guy, that Frank Thomas-ish. I'm not calling Frank Thomas. I'm just talking about the appeal that these big guys have. And they mean a lot to the development of the younger guys. They give a sense of security and a sense of beef in the lineup. So I wish.
And you got Louis Robert coming up, and you have Moncada there, and he is also a Cuban player that can kind of help them make that transition.
Right. And embrace these guys that want to be on the South Side. Because every time that you hear about a guy that goes, oh, I just want to get out of here, or I'm not going to sign here because, here's a guy that's willing to stay here, that's willing to re-sign, that has a good relationship with the manager and the rest of the guys inside the clubhouse. So I think it's important to keep him here. And listen, 32 is the new 26. And so here's a guy that I think that still has good years ahead of him and can be a positive influence in the locker room.
Boy, somebody needs to tell my body if 32 is the new 26.
Because Kevin's 32.
I feel about 42 coming in here in the morning. Now, that is some great advice. I should probably take that to heart. Jose Abreu's enthusiasm is great. You know, he seems like a guy who really has taken to the city and this franchise quite a bit since coming over here back in 2014. Doesn't seem like it's been that long, mostly because the Sox have had very forgettable teams, I guess, over that period of time. But he has been one bright spot. That being said, though, he is a bit of a one-dimensional player at a position where players don't tend to age as well as on other parts of the diamond. Now, his enthusiasm to be here makes you think, though, that potentially, if he signs on for another 2-3 years, I don't know what they're discussing contract lengthwise, but maybe he seems like a guy who wouldn't, you know, make a stink if he became a backup or kind of a role player on this roster. You know, if Gavin Sheets or Zach Collins or Reed or whomever else ascends and becomes the first baseman of the future, so to speak, it seems like Abreu could be one of those guys that you keep around on the bench just to play a couple times a week, be that mentor for the younger players. And seeing him kiss the White Sox logo on the helmet after he hit the walk-off a few nights ago in that last game was something I thought was very special. Something reminiscent, of course, of European soccer. Kissing the badge, Mully, means quite a bit, you know that. So him kissing the logo, to me, means that, yes, he does want to be here, and maybe they'll be able to get him on a favorable contract.
I mean, I do like his enthusiasm, absolutely. Does it influence me on wanting him to stay? Sure, I love what he brings. I mean, this guy is really having a great year, first of all. I mean, he's second in the AL with 66 RBIs. I mean, he's having a really good year offensively. But also what he brings to the team, I mean, in terms of leadership, you could just see it on the field. I think back to the incident in Kansas City with Tim Anderson and the bat flip game and how he was the guy that grabbed Tim Anderson and pulled him to the side so things didn't escalate. Things like that. I mean, he's a good clubhouse influence. So to me, yes, a guy who is producing for you and is a good influence in the clubhouse, I think, is a win, especially when he's as outspoken as he is about wanting to stay. Now, do the White Sox need him is another question. I mean, they could surely flip him now while his value is high and get something for him. Yes, absolutely. But I think there is value to keeping him for the White Sox, especially with a team full of young players.
Yeah, I'm with Tom here, and not just because he's 400 yards away from me and can crush me, but, you know, this Jose, of course his enthusiasm, that's contagious. And Tom, you said, embrace the guys that want to be on the South Side. Amen. I mean, who is it that Abreu's getting in the way of as far as advancing them or progressing? Was that Mully?
Eventually it will be Andrew Vaughn, but that's a couple years away.
Yeah, but I'm saying right, you know, now or next year. Now, if you can get something for him right this second, fine, and then bring him back, right? Like, with the idea, fine. Leave, get assets, come back, even on a team-friendly deal, absolutely. But, I mean, yes, I think the Sox need him. I think he's good for the Sox. I think he sets a good example. I would want Jose Abreu on my team for sure.
Over Anthony Rizzo?
No.
That is an unbelievably great question.
How different would the Bears be right now if Cody Parkey's double doink had fallen through the uprights, and what would have been the biggest difference in the offseason?
I think they'd have a lot more pressure on them. Backup success with success brings a lot of pressure because now it amps up the way every one of your opponent approaches you in preparation to play you when you have a certain amount of success, just like it will be this year. And, you know, that's one of the most difficult things to do is you bring in a new head coach, you're developing a young quarterback, you're starting to gain some positive momentum, and then all of a sudden you have that rug pulled out from underneath your feet when the kicker does mess up at the end of the season. So you ask, what's the biggest difference in the offseason? If they would have made the kick, Cody Parkey would still be here.
Right.
And then you would sit there and live all offseason with the questions of some of his inadequacies from last season if they were going to come back and haunt you again this year. So what they did, yeah, they missed the kick. I think it ended on a positive note because before I got here in 85, I hear a lot of stories talked about the 84 Bears when they got beat in San Francisco, how the conversation on the airplane was, is we're going to be a better team next year and we're not going to allow this to happen to us again before we do achieve success. And the next year they went on to win the Super Bowl. And I got to be a part of it and see the growth and what the 84 loss meant to the 85 team. And I think there's a lot of similarities in what this loss against Philly can mean to this year's team. And so success and backing up success is interesting, but I think Mitchell Trubisky is going to be a better quarterback this year than the challenges he faced last year in the whole learning process with Coach Nagy, all the new offensive system with Coach Helfrich and stuff that they were putting in. And it's tough to learn football and play football. Now I think Mitchell Trubisky knows football and will be able to play better football.
You know, I really believe this. I think if they had won that game, they'd have gone to Los Angeles and beaten the Rams.
I
really believe that's a good matchup for them. I think one of the things going on in Los Angeles, they don't draw a crowd. I think the Bear fans would have gone there en masse. I think it would have probably ended in the NFC Championship game against New Orleans, and I think New Orleans probably would have gone to the Super Bowl, and I don't know if that would have changed the Super Bowl, but I think a lot of things in the league might have changed, but I think the number one thing for the Bears would be Vic Fangio would still be here. I think that missed field goal cost the Bears Vic Fangio. I like Chuck Pagano. I think he's a leader of men, and I think he'll be fine. I also think the talent level on that defense is so good, but they're going to miss Vic Fangio. That is a guy who, really, you know, he's a play caller. He's a guy that understands how to match up to another team. Chuck Pagano hasn't done that in a number of years and didn't do it for a very long time when he did last do it. So I think that's probably the most impactful difference. I think this defense is still getting better. I think Khalil Mack with a full off season, the guy talks about wanting to be great. I want to hear that all day, every day, and he backs it up by working the way that he works. So I think that's going to be something fun. Roquan, we'll see throughout the course of that defense how many guys can raise their level. But to me, the biggest difference would be the defense. You wouldn't have a question of whether or not Chuck Pagano
could
really be the play caller.
You really think that Fangio would have stayed here?
Well, I don't think he would have had a choice. I don't think he would have had a head coaching job, and why would he not stay here for another year?
Well, I figured the deeper they go in the playoffs, the more sought after he would have been.
No,
more
it,
teams
works
would have
wanted him. It works the other way. It works the other way. You know, Denver had a – who was going to hire Vic Fangio as their head coach? Denver was because of the players they have on defense. I don't think they'd have waited 2 weeks.
I think if the Bears win the Super Bowl last year, every team would want Vic Fangio.
Are you paying attention? Coaches go to the Super Bowl and it costs them an opportunity to be a head coach. Are you paying attention?
I try to. I mean, it's difficult at this time in the morning, but I just think if I don't know. I feel like the more successful they would have been last year, the more teams would have wanted Vic Fangio other than bowing out early in the playoffs as they did. Now, I think they would have done pretty much the same player acquisitions in the offseason, you know, win or lose, no matter how deep they would have went in the playoffs. I still think you would have seen Clinton Dix come in here, Cordarrelle Patterson, and I still think they would have been looking for a new kicker anyway, because even if Parkey would have made that one against Philadelphia, he missed so many during the regular season, they probably would have had to address that anyway. Who knows what would have happened in the playoffs if they could beat the Rams, if they could beat the Saints. Nobody knows the run they could have went on, you know, what could have been. But I do disagree with you, Bali. I think Vic Fangio would have been gone either way.
You're not paying attention, Kevin. Those jobs are filled. Those jobs get filled, and they get filled quick. People do not sit waiting for coaches. They can't. They got to move forward. Think about it. Think about all the coaches.
Do you think there's any underground communication when someone wants to hire somebody so badly that there's not a little underneath?
I'm looking at the numbers. I'm looking at how many guys, how rare it is for guys to get head coaching jobs out of a Super Bowl. Usually teams move on. And I didn't get the sense, maybe you did, that Denver would have waited on Vic Fangio. I think it was a nice match, and they made it. But they were looking at what's-his-name, too. They had two different people they were working with. So, you know, it wouldn't have surprised me if, you know, could Vic have gone someplace else as a D coordinator? But I don't think he's a head coach. And if you were him and you felt you had the talent level you have here and you're comfortable here, why not come back for another year?
Do you think he's going to be a good head coach?
I don't know.
That's a topic of another day.
Yeah, I think that's a really good question, and I think it's a question.
Well, there were many great points raised here, and I'm going to say, Mully, I agree with the idea that if the double doink doesn't occur, that the Bears would have advanced to that NFC Championship game, but would not have advanced to the Super Bowl. They would have lost to the Saints. I do agree with that. Tom, I agree with the fact that if that happened, if the double doink doesn't happen, Parkey's probably still on the team. I do think there is a chance of that, and you would have had all of those questions, like you said, going into this 2019 season. But I don't think, regardless of this, I think Vic Fangio would have departed. I don't think they would have gone to a Super Bowl. I think he would have gotten this job with Denver regardless. And no matter what the result, the questions surrounding Mitch Trubisky still remain, and I think that doesn't change. I mean, we still need to see what Trubisky's going to bring to the table this season, if he's going to make a big improvement. And so, yeah, that's the biggest, one of the biggest questions surrounding this Bears team, regardless of the outcome of last year.
I think on paper they'd look a lot different. You know, we'll start right off the bat. Mully, your point about Fangio is spot on. Okay, Fangio would still be here without a question. He'd still be here. I believe Cody Parkey would still be here. I might even think Jordan Howard might still be here, which means the Bears would have done something different with the third round pick where they replaced Jordan Howard, right? I think the Super Bowl would have been 1,000 times better with the Bears and or the Saints in the Super Bowl, right? I mean, that was one of the worst, most boring Super Bowls ever. I mean, 3 whole points from the explosive Rams. I think there's a lot of pressure on this Bears team. I think they got a really tough schedule. I'm really hoping for good things. I don't know that the defense is going to go in the toilet without Vic Fangio, but the play calling, it's the play calling, and we're going to have to wait and see how Chuck Pagano calls a defense in a live game. That's a huge question.
Don't ask me about that.
This segment brought to you by Northwestern Football. Join Coach Fitz and the Big Ten West Division champions at Ryan Field this fall when they host Ohio State, Iowa, and more. Season and single game tickets on sale now at nusports.com. Which professional sport has had the better offseason, the NFL or the NBA, and why?
You know, I got to tell you, the NBA offseason has been absolutely unbelievable. First of all, the NFL is the sport of sports, and when the NFL starts, it's gonna rob baseball of a lot of the attention it currently gets. The NFL knows how to run an offseason. They're unbelievable every year. The NFL schedule release is like a big day. Oh my God, who are they playing? What day are they playing them? It's crazy how much the NFL dominates the landscape. But I think the NBA has done a remarkable job this year. The new thing in the NBA is creating these, you know, a duo dynasty or whatever you want to call it, where they get two good players on a team. It used to be the super team, and now what we're seeing is sort of the traveling twosomes. And I love that idea because it means more parity, but I also think that that because of all this movement, the NBA for this season has probably been as dominant. The other thing the NBA does is they go crazy on social media. If you follow, if you're on Twitter, if you're on Instagram, it's absolutely insane. And we've gone from, you know, following Kawhi, what's he going to do? First of all, we had a 24-hour period where they spent $3 billion in free agency. I've never seen anything like that. Then the Kawhi decision and how crazy that was, and the Friday night where you find out it's not just Kawhi, it's also Paul George. And now we're waiting on Wes, and where is he going to wind up? And Russell Westbrook is going to be fantastic to see where Russ goes. So I can't get I can't say the NFL doesn't own the offseason because it does as a sport, but maybe this year the NBA actually beat out the NFL if that's humanly possible.
Well, you know what's one thing crazy is in the NFL, money matters, and the NBA, money doesn't matter. Because if it does, yeah. If it did matter, Kawhi wouldn't have signed with the L.A. Clippers and given up so much possible income with what he could have made with other teams in terms of a max contract and what he's going to have to pay in terms of taxes and everything being out in California. That him signing that contract cost him millions and millions of dollars.
Million.
Right.
Yeah.
That it would have never happened in the NFL. The one thing that's going to dictate this offseason is how productive the collective bargaining agreement talks continue with the NFL. If they can sit there and complete and continue the bargaining at, you know, at the table between the two sides, and they can come together with a new collective extension of the collective bargaining agreement, that's going to pay huge dividends for the NFL, and that's going to give NFL security for years to come. And yeah, the NBA, it's a lot of money, but it we talked about the underground lines of communication in the NFL when you're talking about coaches who are in the playoffs but their agents, oh, I'm not talking to anybody because you can't talk to them. Give me a break.
Yeah,
you know, there's so many avenues of conversation you can have out there in second, third, and fourth party. It's going on, and it's the same thing in the NBA that's kind of frustrating is, hey, you know, sit out or be a bad citizen on your football team for this season so you can make sure that you get yourself traded, and then we'll put everything together, and then we'll go after championships again. Although it would be fun to play with LeBron in L.A. and, you know, everything that's going on there. But again, to me, it's all about if you keep these talks going with the collective bargaining agreement, there's going to be a real security in the NFL for quite a few years.
For me, it's the NBA offseason. I think they have the most entertaining offseason of any of the major sports. You could argue that the NBA offseason is better than the NBA regular season. I mean, not every single game throughout the course of 82 is going to be as riveting as a game come playoff time. So I think it's the NBA offseason, although the NFL draft is an event, you know, in and of itself with the combine and everything that goes into that. And I get why people are so into it, and I get why some of the money in the NBA might turn people off, certain people. I don't know why. I mean, it's all fake money anyway. I mean, what are we really doing here? Is money even a real thing anymore? We're like $800 billion in the red ourselves as a nation. So none of it really matters financially to me. I just like the idea of players bouncing around and superstar players at that moving seemingly every single year to keep shaking things up. I love the NBA offseason.
For me, it's the NBA as well. There's always crazy rumors spreading around like wildfire. There's always a big splash to be made, and it happens. There's always big players constantly, big name players constantly on the move to different teams. The NBA looks different, vastly different every 5 years. To me, it's the NBA.
The NFL, the NFL, the NFL, the NFL, the NFL. And to the reason is, to Kevin's point, that the NBA offseason is better than its regular season. That just means that the NFL is far superior in every which way.
Well, if they played 16 NBA basketball games a season, I'm sure the caliber of play would be a little higher.
312-644-6767 is the telephone number.
Doubt it.
We're gonna get to your calls. He's Tom Thayer. You're listening to Mully and Haw on The Score.
You could spend the weekend doing the same old whatever, or you could conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.